Good afternoon and welcome to 9 a.m. Today, my guest is Susie Newberry. Also publishing name Susanna Newberry, in case you recognize the name. I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a background on Susie before we begin. Susie is an assistant professor of art history at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and her research and teaching interests focus on the social history of 20th and 21st century art, history of photography, architecture, urban studies, and economic geography. Her book, Speculation, Art, Real Estate, and Global Los Angeles, is forthcoming from University of Minnesota Press. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Paul.
When are we going to see this book?
Oh, my God. let's say fall 2019.
Okay.
It's been a 10-year project. It grew out of what I worked on in graduate school, and I've been in my current position at UNLV for 4 years, and turning it into a book, and I'm really excited about it.
How's Vegas?
Vegas is really good right now. It is, you know, it's midterm season, and the thing I like best about Vegas is that when you live there, you never go to the Strip unless you work in hospitality. And the rest of the city is just young, excited, like super, super progressive brown kids. And they all want to vote this year, which is really awesome.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
If you're catching this show later on, we are the last week of October going into the midterm. So that is super important.
Yeah.
And Susie and I have known each other for a bit. When did we meet? A few years back? Possibly.
A little while ago, yeah.
Yeah, so it's nice to have her on the show and chat. Tell me a little bit about this book that you've been working on for a while.
Yeah, so the book, as Paul said, is called Speculations, Art and Real Estate Development in Global LA. And it is kind of a prehistory to what many of you are familiar with right now if you live in Los Angeles, which is the increasing economic development, or if you prefer, gentrification, of inner city districts that go really hand in hand with the growth and proliferation of a critical art scene in Los Angeles. So beginning in the 60s, I look at a couple of different ways in which real estate development or urban renewal or whatever, you know, term or euphemism you want to use is used as uses art as an instrument of urban change. And so in each chapter, I look at one art project that surveys the built environment in some way, and I look at one innovation in real estate development, like the use of parking lots as land banks for revenue, or the development of industrial buildings, low-slung industrial buildings, for the same purpose, and therefore sort of describe the changing nature of Southern California in somewhat counterintuitive ways in terms of how it goes along with the fine arts.
So we know of, maybe not everyone, but when I think of the 60s, I think of like Ferris Gallery and the Venice scene. What is that what you're touching upon, or are we looking at very different parts of the city at that time?
No, we're looking at actually various different parts of the Southland. I don't really talk about the Ferris Gallery or any of the familiar personages per se. What I'm really interested in is drawing sort of larger scale historical conclusions about how these two agents work together. So, for example, I talk a lot about Ed Ruscha's famous 34 parking lots book.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't talk so much about Ruscha the person in terms of his career. I'm interested in his conceptual attachment to the environment that he works in. And then I'm interested in how, as I said before, in downtown LA, at a period of time when the city, its commercial and economic base is out-migrating to the valleys, uses something as bland and ordinary and banal as a parking lot, a sort of neutral piece of infrastructure to conceal machinations of change that are going on below the surface, which I think formally and conceptually is related to Ruscha's photographic strategy. So it's complicated because books are complicated, but I really wanted to look at a socially critical approach to art making and urban change from sort of unorthodox art historical background.
And how is, you know, as you're thinking of Southern California landscape, how has your thought process of this changed since living in Vegas?
Well, Vegas is an interesting city. It also boomed after World War II, like Los Angeles. But in the absence of a diversified sort of industrial economy, it developed purely on hospitality and gambling and a little bit of the military. What you see now is Vegas as a city almost sort of structurally similar to LA in the 50s and 60s, realizing that they need an influx of residents. They need to find alternative revenue streams for municipal income. And they themselves are heavily, speculatively, investing on developing arts districts as ways of both ginning up different kinds of tourism, cultural tourism, and luring, they call them creatives, from LA and other sort of rapidly changing and expensifying cities to come to Vegas instead. So there are a lot of parallels about 60 years apart, I think.
So and when I'm thinking of these, like, you know, these emerging art communities, are we thinking of, like, sculptures that are being put in the, like, in the casinos, or is this more, on the lines of, like, small artist-run spaces or shopping centers that allow for commercial development to occur?
Yeah, well, certainly in Vegas now, and very much on the model of Los Angeles, also New York, other big cities, there is a sense that a large physical sculpture standing as a work of art will draw people into an enclosed space and cause them to spend money. I mean, that's one of the ideas of having art in public, but also art in enclosed spaces, is to galvanize a population to be held in space in order to gather, but also to expend, you know, money and generate revenue. In Vegas, the interesting thing is that we do have, for example, a Percent for Art program. There is an interest in public sculpture outside of casino spaces, which are privately held. But our real estate developers themselves, the people building condo towers and trying to renovate commercial space that's been disused for more sort of high-end boutique production, are sort of skipping the step, which I think is essentially played by artists in interesting ways, which is to allow for preferential rents for people without other resources to come together, form their own institutional interests, and develop something that is by themselves and for their artistic community. Instead, what we see largely are people building condo towers who create storefront space on the ground level, and they lease it at very short-term amounts to artists who will do something that faces the street in order to brand the building as artistic. So we're seeing this sort of assumption of the idea of the art worker or artist into a realm of cultural branding that I think rhetorically is very slippery, but also probably pretty effective for good or for ill.
So we're seeing plop art, but we're also seeing these artists coming in. And are these people who are from the local community are being brought in through there, or are these, like, people that are being, you know, cherry-picked from other parts of the country?
It's interesting. Right now, it's mostly people from Las Vegas. And that in and of itself, I think, is great. I think it's very important to give institutional recognition to people who are working in their local circumstances and who want to be there. But what is clear to me personally, and with the sort of benefit of 10 years of researching this dynamic and 4 years of living in Las Vegas, is that such artists occupy a moment in transition and will sort of necessarily need to seek other platforms for their work once their presence has solidified the sort of resale value of those kinds of properties for an entirely different population of people with a little more money and a little more expendable capital, who will invigorate, in the words of sort of city planners and developers, Vegas's disused downtown core. So whereas I see the transition happening now in L.A. and Boyle Heights and elsewhere as the product of, again, 50 or 60 years of that kind of development, we see it in a compressed timeline in Las Vegas that's looking for sort of turnaround, I'd say, in the 10 to 15-year range.
Yeah, I mean, this feels very similar to downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the recession and sort of these, you know, these empty storefronts that started to, you know, I don't even know if it still exists, but I think it does, is, you know, the downtown art walk. Mm-hmm. And so you know, you have all these buildings that that are both coming up or are on a sort of a standstill, and you know, we do have these storefronts where we see these temporary things pop up. So we start bringing in like more of a creative class that because of something like Los Angeles, it's much more diverse and much more open with how we're even defining that, Hollywood, et cetera. But we're seeing this sort of massive flock of people coming through, and things are arising. They're much, you know, they're very temporary, and keys are being shifted very quickly. And I imagine that, you know, that still does exist, but that the level of value to that seems less important as we exit the recession. And it's no surprise that, you know, we see areas like Broadway or Main Street and these areas that have become much more financially viable. Mm-hmm. With the, you know, Ace Hotel to these old, you know,
Urban Outfitters.
Exactly.
I forget which movie palace that was.
Exactly. Yeah. And that idea of it sort of feels the natural next step where you're having that urban, you know, experience.
Yeah.
But rather than it being much more temporary, it's much more of an expensive build out.
Yeah, and a couple things to point out there about similarities and differences between LA and Vegas. We have a First Friday, so an art walk once a month. And although I was very negative about it when I first got to Vegas, one of the things I understand about it now is that in a city that's sprawling and multi-nucleated, but also in a city whose workforce works in three shifts and so rarely synchronizes to have public time or public space together, Art Walk is an incredible gravitational pull, especially for young people who may otherwise be sort of like balkanized in their neighborhoods or their districts. So I see the value in an Art Walk in terms of creating some semblance of public gathering. The thing you're mentioning about Broadway and downtown LA is that one of the ways LA has thought about coming out of the recession or sort of revitalizing downtown economically is through adaptive reuse and historical preservation. And that's a big difference between LA and Vegas. Vegas does not really have a culture of either adaptive reuse or historic preservation. I think that causes these things to play out in different ways. But just to say, if anyone is listening in Vegas, I think it's great that you go to Art Walk or First Friday or whatever it's called. And I hope that you use that experience to inspire you to, you know, make your own kinds of public settings for art viewing that are important to you in addition to being accessible to many people.
I love that last comment you were saying about how, because I think of Los Angeles so much as a space that doesn't hold on to its own history, even though those buildings are still there, and Vegas taking it to sort of to the next step. And I guess it's just Southern California as a whole.
Yeah.
So on each of my shows, I ask writers to either bring a text that is of their own writing or something that they've been thinking a lot about. And so today, Susie, what did you bring for us?
So today I brought one of my, it's one of my favorite pieces of American writing, and it's Frederick Douglass's July 4th, 1852 speech, which is colloquially known as What to the Slave is the 4th of July. And earlier Paul was asking me, you know, why did you bring this? What does it mean to you? I began reading it while I was in graduate school in a course on American art. We read from the, I forget, it's like a Signet paperback, Three American Slave Narratives. And I picked it up again, let's just say 6 years ago, because it was republished in The Nation in 2012, and it happened to be going around in a link. And I read it at least three times a year at this point. I always read it on the 4th of July, which on the one hand feels a little overdetermined, but on the other hand, it gives me a sort of profound sense of urgency, which I like. And I find myself reading it at different points, especially when issues of national politics, personal liberty, and justice sort of coincide. And so we first talked about doing this over the summer, and I knew that this was the text I wanted to bring because it's the text I read most often, and it seems somewhat fitting this week to be able to be here and talk about it.
There we go. So where do you want to begin with that?
I'd like to read the first section. Can I describe it a little bit?
Sure. The whole piece? Of course.
So the whole piece is a speech that was directed at a congregation of, and I don't necessarily mean religious, but, you know, a gathering of white people, white Northerners, in 1852. And it reflects on the occasion. They had invited him to speak on the 4th of July about issues of liberty. Frederick Douglass was, of course, famously born enslaved, but had achieved emancipation at this point in time. The first part of it is, it's quite long. It's like a 20-minute or half an hour disquisition about what the 4th of July means in terms of the official rhetoric of the state. So independence from Britain, the throwing off of colonial rule, and the enshrinement of personal liberty as a matter of state. And then it moves into a sort of personal reflection on what that national rhetoric means to someone who was born enslaved and who continues to live in a country where enslavement is also enshrined, though not legally in the Constitution, culturally in society as something viable. And I think he maintains this very interesting dialectic or conversation throughout. What does liberty mean in a culture that continues to constrain liberty for a large portion of its population, and specifically a large portion of its population that does most of the work to actually allow the country to function, especially on a global scale? So that's sort of a broad sketch of what we'll be reading from.
So when is it, just can you put this a little bit in historical context? Where are we sitting, you know, in terms of the Civil War? Why at this moment, I guess?
Yeah. I was afraid you were going to ask that. And I just want to note, I'm not an American historian, though I should be. I should know these things. So let's think about it from a California point of view. 1848 is the conclusion of the Mexican-American War. The United States acquires California and a vast portion of the United States West and begins drawing state lines to define, in terms of national sovereignty, what belongs to the United States versus what belongs to Mexico. In 1850, there are various laws that are passed or sort of conflagrations that come up. The Fugitive Slave Act is one. The Kansas-Missouri Compromise is another. There's a lot going on both locally and abroad, especially in Crimea, which is now Ukraine or Russia, depending on how you see it, about the question of sovereignty, citizenship, nationhood, and who gets to exert control over vast quantities of people who, up until that point, understand their lives in terms of local circumstances more than national or global circumstances. So I also think about this work in those geopolitical terms of the 19th century.
And, you know, the Civil War, which ended up happening, so this is 1852, and the Civil War beginning in 1861. So this is, you know, this is less than 10 years before. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, I would imagine, you know, we're at this point where, you know, tension is building. So this is a marker in that.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Mm. Thank you for summarizing that. So well done.
Sometimes you have to double check your dates as I'm looking at my cell phone.
Me too.
So where do you want to begin on this speech?
Let me just read the first. I'm going to start off on the first page, and I'm going to try to get through the second half of the second page. This is the section that is about talking to this gathering of white Americans about the 4th of July. And so Frederick Douglass begins, "Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, this for the purpose of this celebration is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your mind back to the day and to the act of your great deliverance and to the signs and to the wonders associated with that act and that day. This celebration also marks the beginning of another year of your national life. And it reminds you that the Republic of America is now 76 years old. I am glad, fellow citizens, that your nation is so young. 76 years, though a good old age for a man, is but a mere speck in the life of a nation. 70 years is the allotted time for individual men, but nations number their years by thousands. According to this fact, you are, even now, only in the beginning of your national career, still lingering in the period of childhood. I repeat, I'm glad this is so. There is hope in the thought, and hope is much needed under the dark clouds which lower above the horizon. Fellow citizens, I shall not presume to dwell at length on the associations that cluster about this day. The simple story of it is that 76 years ago, the people of this country were British subjects. The style and title of your, quote, sovereign people, in which you now glory, was not then born. You were under the British crown. Your fathers esteemed the English government as the home government and England as the fatherland. This home government, you know, although a considerable distance from your home, did, in the exercise of its parental prerogatives, impose upon its colonial children such restraints, burdens, and limitations as, in its mature judgment, it deemed wise, right, and proper. But your fathers, who had not adopted the fashionable idea of this day of the infallibility of government and the absolute character of its acts, presumed to differ from the home government in respect to the wisdom and the justice of some of those burdens and restraints. They went so far in their excitement as to pronounce the measures of government unjust, unreasonable, and oppressive, and altogether such as ought not to be quietly submitted to. I scarcely need say, fellow citizens, that my opinion of those measures fully accords with that of your fathers. Feeling themselves harshly and unjustly treated by the home government, your fathers, like men of honesty and men of spirit, earnestly sought redress. They petitioned and remonstrated. They did so in a decorous, respectful, and loyal manner. Their conduct was wholly unexceptionable. This, however, did not answer the purpose. They saw themselves treated with sovereign indifference, coldness, and scorn. Yet they persevered. They were not the men to look back. As the sheet anchor takes a firmer hold when the ship is tossed by the storm, so did the cause of your fathers grow stronger as it breasted the chilling blasts of kingly displeasure. The greatest and best of British statesmen admitted its justice, and the loftiest eloquence of the British Senate came to its support. But with that blindness which seems to be the unvarying characteristic of tyrants, since Pharaoh and his host were drowned in the Red Sea, the British government persisted in the exactions complained of. The madness of this course, we believe, is admitted now even by England, but we fear the lesson is wholly lost on our present ruler. Oppression makes a wise man mad. Your fathers were wise men, and if they did not go mad, they became restive under this treatment. They felt themselves the victim of grievous wrongs, wholly incurable in their colonial capacity. With brave men, there is always a remedy for oppression. Just here, the idea of a total separation of the colonies from the crown was born. It was a startling idea, much more so than we at this distance of time regard it. The timid and the prudent, as has been intimated of that day, were of course shocked and alarmed by it. Such people lived then, had lived before, and will probably ever have a place on this planet. And their course in respect to any great change, no matter how great the good to be attained or the wrong to be redressed by it, may be calculated with as much precision as can be the course of the stars. They hate all changes but silver, gold, and copper change. Of this sort of change, they are always strongly in favor.
I think it's a good moment to stop. There's a couple of things that I think are super interesting that are coming out as you read. One is pronouns, mm-hmm. and the shift from, you would think there would be an inclusive, we would be speaking about it inclusively, us, mm-hmm. we, mm-hmm. But instead there's a separation between the speaker and his audience. It's mm-hmm. it's your father, mm-hmm. it's their father, it's everything is referring to the people who he's speaking to, and it's about their experience, mm-hmm. and he intentionally chooses to not include himself in that.
Yeah, and I think historically part of this is he's speaking to a group of people who are sympathetic with the causes of abolition. And he's, of course, standing there in person. There's no radio, there's no TV. You know, like, he's there as a black person who they have invited as a former enslaved person to be there. And so the distinction between liberty of self and liberty of affinity or racial or cultural origin is stark. But I agree with you that as a piece of rhetoric, the use of pronouns that isolates his audience from his own experience, even as he talks about what should be collective history, is super interesting. And building on that, I think the other thing that's interesting, even in this passage and that will continue throughout the speech, is that he uses the language of Christian religion, which makes sense in the time. It makes sense in terms of Frederick Douglass. It makes sense even in terms of sort of how nations are founded under the Enlightenment, with this delicate balance between belief in a higher power or good and freedom of religion and separation of church and state. But rhetorically, he uses this language to indicate that he is a man of God, he is on par with these other people because of their common faith, even as he makes the subtle distinction of how they're separate or different because of laws that apply to the citizenship or station of each individual person.
The last thing I want to comment, which I know will come much more thoroughly throughout, is the compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Your wise fathers, these brave men, and I know that that continues into it, and it's sort of, there's a seduction of to the viewer, mm-hmm. Bringing them in, giving them a compliment, you should be proud of all the hard work that that those before you did, this great nation, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, I think several things about that. I think that's a commonplace of 19th century rhetoric. I was listening to a recording, actually, as I drove over here just to get myself prepared. And in 19th century speech, and I think before, there's a lot of this kind of what I'd call like an invocation to the muse, sort of like, I am not worthy of what I'm about to say. I'm just a conduit for God or whatever. You are also great. We're all at ease here. We all recognize that we start from a common foundation. And I think in rhetoric, in general, it's useful to begin on common ground, in deracinated terms, because it gets the audience on your side. And I think, as we'll see soon, that's certainly something that Douglass is doing. He is paying the compliment forward in order to be able to have the foothold that he needs to launch his critique.
Great. Where would you like to continue?
I'll do the next sort of page.
Great.
On the 2nd of July, 1776, the Old Continental Congress, to the dismay of lovers of ease and the worshippers of property, clothed that dreadful ideal with all the authority of national sanction. They did so in the form of a resolution. Citizens, your fathers made good on that resolution. They succeeded, and today you reap the fruits of their success. The freedom gained is yours, and you, therefore, may properly celebrate this anniversary. The 4th of July is the first great fact in your nation's history, the very ringbolt in the chain of your yet undeveloped destiny. Pride and patriotism, not less than gratitude, prompt you to celebrate and to hold it in perpetual remembrance. I have said that the Declaration of Independence is the ringbolt to the chain of your nation's destiny. So indeed I regard it. The principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by those principles, be true to them on all occasions, in all places, against all foes, and at whatever cost. Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect to the fathers of this republic. They were signers of the Declaration of Independence, and they were brave men. They were great men, too, great enough to give fame to a great age. They loved their country better than their own private interests. And though this is not the highest form of human excellence, all will concede that it is a rare virtue, and that when it is exhibited, it ought to command respect. They were peacemen, but they preferred revolution to peaceful submission to bondage. They were quiet men, but they did not shrink from agitating against oppression. They showed forbearance, but that they knew its limits. They believed in order, but not in the order of tyranny. With them, nothing was settled that was not right. With them, justice, liberty, and humanity were final, not slavery and oppression. You may well cherish the memory of such men. They were great in their day and generation. Their solid manhood stands out the more as we contrast it with these degenerate times. And I'd actually like to continue, if that's okay.
Sure, go for it.
My business, if I have any here today, is with the present. The accepted time with God and his cause is the ever-living now. And then Douglas quotes, trust no future, however pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act in the living present, heart within, and God overhead. And that's the end of the quotation. Douglas continues, we have to do with the past only as we can make it useful to the present and to the future. To all inspiring motives, to noble deeds which can be gained from the past, we are welcome. But now is the time, the important time. Your fathers have lived, died, and have done their work, and have done much of it well. You live and must die, and you must do your work. What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble altering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, both for your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light and my burdens easy and delightful. But such is not the state of the case. I say with a sad sense of the disparity between us, I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak here today? Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains, heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day. May my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with a popular theme would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondsman, making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we return to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce, with all the emphasis I can command, everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command. And yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice or who is not at heart a slaveholder shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. It is not astonishing that while we are plowing, planting, and reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God, and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? That he is the rightful owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongness of slavery? There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What, am I to argue that it's wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with the lash, to load their limbs with irons, to hunt them with dogs, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families, to knock out their teeth, to bum their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employments for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? That God did not establish it? That our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There's blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may. I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but the thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that, for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. The next section that he goes into is to talk about the American slave trade, and it has to do with sort of like internal circumstances of hypocrisy, but as you can see, what he just did was to sort of call back to the founding principles of the Constitution to conflate them through like an even more personal and perhaps longer and deeper sense of moral ethics, and therefore to showcase through the terms of his own audience why the present condition they continue to operate under is deserving of revolution, not only of politics, but also of mind.
Well, yeah, the flip has happened. We're no longer in the compliment, but it's this is where we are at this moment. This is why it's not working, and I'm not even going to justify the reasoning for that. Mm-hmm. It's an understood fact.
Yeah, which of course, today we have a similar problem. Not with enslavement in the same terms, but with the understanding of what a fact is, and what decency is, and so on and so forth. And so another reason I think that this speech is interesting and why I read it all the time is that Douglass is also talking about what binds us together as humans, and what binds us together in humans is respect for the dignity of each person. And he's successful to a certain extent in this speech in pointing out that if you disregard the dignity of a fellow person, a fellow human, you yourself are a hypocrite before the nation and before God. And in the 19th century, that worked for the abolitionists. I don't know that we've sort of found that same either like nadir or plateau, depending on how you think about it today.
So we have about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Where would you like to continue in this in order, or are there certain passages that stick that seem important?
So one of the next things he does is he talks about his own experience as a formerly enslaved person. So I think that next section, when he talks about the slave trade, is interesting because it makes generalized statements about ethics and morality personal. Again, not to be overbearing, but when we think about media and news and visual rhetoric, we also have these kind of narrative strategies. How do you bring something home? How do you personalize it? So just so we are on the same plate, what if I read from this next section up until religious liberty on page 9? Is that okay?
Sure.
Take the American slave trade, which we are told by the papers is especially prosperous just now. This trade is one of the peculiarities of American institutions. It's carried on in all the large towns and cities in one half of this Confederacy, and millions are pocketed every year by dealers in this horrid traffic. In several states, this trade is a chief source of wealth. It is called, in contradistinction to the foreign slave trade, the internal slave trade. Behold, the practical operations of this internal slave trade, the American slave trade, sustained by American politics and American religion. Here you will see women and men reared like swine for the market. You know what is a swine drover? I will show you a man drover. They inhabit all our southern states. They perambulate the country and crowd the highways of the nation with droves of human stock. You will see one of these human flesh jobbers armed with a pistol, whip, and bowie knife, driving a company of 100 men, women, and children from the Potomac to the slave market at New Orleans. These wretched people are to be sold singly or in lots to suit purchasers. They are food for the cotton field and the deadly sugar mill. Mark the sad procession as it moves warily along and the inhuman wretch who drives them. Hear his savage yells and his blood-chilling oaths as he hurries on his affrighted captives. There, see the old man with locks thinned and gray? Cast one glance, if you please, upon that young mother whose shoulders are bare to the scorching sun, her briny tears falling on the brow of the babe in her arms. See, too, that girl of 13, weeping, yes, weeping, as she thinks of the mother from whom she has been torn. The drove moves tardily. Heat and sorrow have nearly consumed their strength. Suddenly you hear a quick snap, like the discharge of a rifle. The fetters clank and the chain rattles simultaneously. Your ears are saluted with a scream that seems to have torn its way to the center of your soul. The crack you heard was the sound of the slave whip. The screams you heard was from the woman you saw with the babe. Her speed had faltered under the weight of her child in her chains. That gash on her shoulder tells her to move on. Follow the droves to New Orleans. Attend the auction. See the men examined like horses. See the forms of women rudely and brutally exposed to the shocking gaze of American slave buyers. See this drove sold and separated forever, and never forget the deep, sad sobs that arose from that scattered multitude. Tell me, citizens, where under the sun you can witness a spectacle more fiendish and shocking? Yet this is but a glance at the American slave trade as it exists at this moment in the ruling part of the United States. I was born amid such sights and scenes. To me, the American slave trade is a terrible reality. In the deep, still darkness of midnight, I have been often aroused by the dead, heavy footsteps and the piteous cries of the chained gangs that passed our door. The anguish of my boyish heart was intense, and I was often consoled when speaking to my mistress in the morning to hear her say that the custom was very wicked, that she hated to hear the rattle of the chains and the heart-rending cries. I was glad to find one who sympathized with me in my horror. Fellow citizens, this murderous traffic is today in active operation in this boasted republic. In the solitude of my spirit, I see clouds of dust raised on the highways of the South. I see bleeding footsteps. I hear the doleful wail of fettered humanity on the way to the slave markets, where victims are to be sold like horses, sheep, and swine, knocked off to the highest bidder. There I see the tenderest ties ruthlessly broken to gratify the lust, caprice, and rapacity of the buyers and sellers of men. My soul sickens at the sight. But a still more inhuman, disgraceful, and scandalous state of things remains to be presented. By an act of the American Congress, not yet 2 years old, slavery has been nationalized in its most horrible and revolting form. By that act, Mason and Dixon's line has been obliterated. New York has become as Virginia, and the power to hold, hunt, and sell men, women, and children as slaves remains no longer a mere state institution, but is now an institution of the whole United States. The power is coextensive with the Star-Spangled Banner and American Christianity. Where these go, may also go the merciless slave hunter. Where these are, man is not sacred. He is a bird for the sportsman's gun. Your broad Republican domain is a hunting ground for men. Not for thieves and robbers, enemies of society merely, but for men guilty of no crime. Your lawmakers have commanded all good citizens to engage in this hellish sport. Your president, your secretary of state, your lords, nobles, and ecclesiastics enforce as a duty you owe to your free and glorious country and to your God that you do this accursed thing. Not fewer than 40 Americans have, within the past 2 years, been hunted down and without a moment's warning, hurried away in chains and consigned to slavery and excruciating torture. Some of these have had wives and children dependent on them for bread. But of this no account was made. The right of the hunter to his prey stands superior to the right of marriage and to all rights in this republic, the rights of God included. For black men, there are neither law, justice, humanity, not religion. His own testimony is nothing. He can bring no witnesses for himself. The minister of American justice is bound by the law to hear but one side, and that side is the side of the oppressor. Let this damning fact be perpetually told. Let it be thundered around the world that in tyrant-killing, king-hating, people-loving, democratic, Christian America, the seats of justice are filled with judges who hold their offices under an open and palpable bribe and are bound in deciding the case of a man's liberty, hear only his accusers. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's intense, but
I think that last line is super important, where he talks about, you know, nothing feels more contemporary than the element of the judges,
mm-hmm.
That moment of the people who hold on to the law, mm-hmm. and deem what law is, and mm-hmm. and that level of subjectivity which exists in that state, mm-hmm. and that being by men met. You know, men of the country at this moment, men of the country at this moment,
mm-hmm.
and sort of where we are at this second, and the power of those positions.
Yeah, I was also thinking on the way over, when I was in grad school, I took a bunch of classes that read really heavily in political philosophy, especially having to do with refugees and migrants and displaced people. And one of the things such authors like, there you go, Giorgio Agamben, argue is that, you know, what is justice if it is not something that is flexible and true? Because there's a difference between law and justice. You know, law is something constructed and enforceable, and perhaps justice, though we think of it in different terms in the United States, is moral. Or ethical, or ethics. I mean, that's a whole other field of inquiry. But, you know, again, in the past couple of months, we've, as a nation, like, found ourselves witness to a moment that could open on to those debates in a very powerfully personal way. And we've seen them foreclosed on the side of law. This is a settled matter. This context doesn't matter. This testimony doesn't matter. This video footage doesn't matter. We've all agreed that laws are laws and therefore must be enforced. And while that might be constitutionally true and legally so, it certainly doesn't make it correct, or right, I guess, not correct. And one can still sense that even if those laws must be enforced, it doesn't make them just. And what is a nation or a republic that can't respond in that way to correct itself when new circumstances present the case for it?
Well, I think that's a great place to close our conversation.
I'm so glad I spent Sunday talking about this with you, Paul. I laugh, but I genuinely am. It's fun to talk about these things.
Yeah. And any other closing comments before we close out the show? Thinking back on this text specifically.
You know, so I teach at a public institution. I am an employee of my state, and it's my job in the classroom to present information and to present a context where really important issues can be openly debated, both as a matter of opinion and history. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm grateful to be employed in a circumstance where my job is to help people reason and analyze. When you invited me on the show, I thought, okay, it's Paul, he's an artist, like maybe I should bring some art text, like I could find something from my art theory class to read. And that felt so beside the point. And so I guess one of the reasons I read this text and reflect on it is that it calls me to consider the stakes of my profession, my research, my person. And I think that no matter the time, thinking about ethics and subjecthood and citizenship and self-possession are important, whether you deal with art or some other circumstance. And so just again, I'm glad to have had the opportunity to do this with you.
Well, thank you so much, Susie. And thank you, everyone, for listening today. This is 9 a.m., and have a lovely afternoon. Thank you.